This week, the precious metals moved higher while the Dow Jones Industrials posted its best close in 117 years. Welcome, everybody. Great to be back with you. We've got another must-hear GoldSeek.com radio broadcast. Your host, Chris Walczyk, here with you for a guest triple header. First out of the batter's box, hailing from scenic Zurich, Switzerland, Jim Rogers. He's batting 1,000 with his investment plan for 2015. He's got plans to increase his gold stockpile at around $1,000 an ounce. Next, Peter Elides of Stock Market Cycles shares a market timing technique he's developed. He thinks we're in for a big smackdown in the S&P 500. Then the silver investor David Morgan views the dollar strength as simply capital flight from the EU zone. He thinks trillions of dollars will flood into the tiny precious metals markets as the bond market implosion continues over the next few years. Then Robert Ian wraps up the show with his latest report. We'd like for you to call into our toll-free hotline with your questions and comments. You can do so 24/7, and you can leave your first name if you like, or you can stay anonymous, 120-6666-5370. GoldSeek.com radio begins now with the market weather recapitulation. Partly sunny skies appeared over the precious metals sector this week on continued U.S. dollar market weakness. Investors sold the greenback in favor of the safe haven on news of conflicting employment numbers from the Labor Department. At Friday's closing bell on the New York COMEX exchange, the gold market was up $10, adding about 1%, finishing at $11.87 an ounce. Silver picked up 30 cents, about 2%, finishing at $16.42 an ounce, while the XAU and gold silver index dropped 1%, ending at $72.50. West Texas Intermediate crude added 21 cents, just shy of $60 per barrel. The top story this week stemmed from the Labor Department report on Friday. Precious metals gained considerable ground, as well as U.S. stocks, on news that employers added fewer than expected jobs to the economy. The Labor Department released a non-farm payroll report of about 223,000 jobs, just a little lower than expected. Nevertheless, the unemployment rate fell to a seven-year low, catching many off guard. And I think investors tend to watch this a bit more closely than the actual numbers. The national unemployment rate fell 0.1% from 5.5% to 5.4% in March. The metals rallied on the news as investors sold the dollar in anticipation that the Fed would hold its rate hikes until the fall. Many analysts are calling for a September or December FOMC rate hike, and I'm on board with that group. Elsewhere, a precious metals sector hero, the London metals trader and market rigging whistleblower, Andrew Maguire, announced the big commercial traders have established such huge short positions in the gold and silver markets that the pendulum is about to swing back in a big way. He sees a reversal in the monetary metals thanks to insider bullion banks. He added that China is on the brink of winning the gold war against the West. China conducted trial runs for the planned yuan-denominated gold fix last month, moving closer to creating a benchmark price. The Shanghai Gold Exchange conducted the tests with major Chinese banks, viewed as a positive for the sector. Precious metals bottom line. Well, this week, Market Watch's Hulbert released an interesting report, which shows the Hulbert Gold Sentiment Index is still in dangerously bearish territory. He makes a compelling case to be cautious. In addition, we are seeing ominous head and shoulders patterns forming in the gold and silver as well as XAU markets. So the onus is clearly on the bulls. You might want to log into the Alpha Stocks newsletter account for all of my analysis on the sector by Monday of next week. Moving on to the Wall Street Report, mostly sunny skies appeared over the New York Stock Exchange this week on Wednesday after Fed Chairwoman Janet Yellen called valuations in the stock market a bit high. Shares fell sharply, but they recovered in the opposite direction on Friday, adding nearly 300 points in the Dow in a single session amid the stronger than expected unemployment rate report. The Dow Jones Industrials ended at its highest close, weekly close, that is, in its 118-year history at 18,200, about 167 points for the week, 1%. The S&P 500 picked up about 8 points, closing at 2067, less than 0.5%, while the Nasdaq dropped merely 2 points, essentially at break-even, above that 5,000 level. Well, according to the Wall Street Journal report, there's only a 7% chance the Fed will raise rates in July. September, the odds go up to 22%. October, 38%. And by December, 55%. Pretty solid odds that we'll see that rate hike this year. Bottom line on Wall Street. Our favorite 7 indicator sentiment index remains in the greedy zone, but the NASDAQ and the S&P calmed down a bit this week. That's viewed as a positive. Odds still suggest a move sharply higher in the coming weeks. Coming up after the break, more GoldSeek.com radio with Jim Rogers, the adventure capitalist, David Morgan, and Peter Eliades. So we'd like for you to stay with us right here at GoldSeek. Well, it's a pleasure to welcome back Jim Rogers, not from the typical Singapore office, but today halfway the other way around the world in Zurich, Switzerland. Hello, Jim.
Thank you very, very much, Chris.
I thought we could begin today with the remarkable rebound we've seen recently in West Texas Intermediate crude. After many months of powerful selling, one of the biggest downdrafts since the last oil bubble, the market has been on the move. Tell us your thoughts here, please.
Well, the Arabia started dumping oil, and oil started going down because America went to Saudi Arabia and said, okay, you dump oil so we can get our way with Iran and with Russia. Saudi Arabia was happy to do that because they wanted to try to slow down fracking. Oil has been a politically manipulated, if you will, a motivated market. It went down probably too much. It is now rebounding. The Saudis are spending a lot of their reserves now. They have plenty of reserves, so they can do this for a long time. But I think they're starting to understand that this is not as much fun as we thought it would be. So I suspect you'll see oil make a bottom this year if it hasn't already made it.
Well, you know, the precious metals sector, many of our guests remain staunchly bullish on the sector, but I think the technical work seems to indicate a final consolidation breakdown, you know, a final capitulation as soon as maybe this year. Perhaps it'll take the Fed to pull the trigger on higher rates, get that out of the way for the typical investor to come back in. What are your thoughts?
Well, I'm not buying gold or silver at the moment. I own them both. And have for a long time. I haven't really been a buyer of gold for about 5 years for some of the reasons. Well, not the technical reasons, because I don't know much about technical analysis, but I do know gold went up 12 years in a row, which is unusual. So the consolidation is going to be unusual, or is being unusual. I happen to concur with you that, you know, there hasn't been a washout yet, a shakeout. There's still too many people who believe that gold is holy, and until some of them give up and throw out gold out the window, I hope I'm smart enough to buy when that happens. But that could be under $1,000 an ounce. Could be. That's not a prediction. But even if, you know, gold has not been down 50% in years. Well, most assets go down 50% every 4 or 5 years, if not more. So gold is unusual. I'm waiting. If there's a final washout, I hope I'm smart enough to buy gold and silver.
Very good. And equities, U.S. equities have been red hot. Of course, the Shanghai Index, recently one of the most explosive markets on record, with unbelievable number of new account openings in that region. Apparently, their passion, their love affair for equities eclipses even us here in the United States. Give us your thoughts here, please.
You may remember China is my largest country of shareholding. I do own a fair amount in China. I'm not selling. I bought more recently. It looks like there is a bubble developing, Chris, and bubbles, as you know, always end badly. But before they end, people can make a lot of money on the upside. Now, this is not my style. I'm not very good at bubbles, but I'm hoping that I can get it right this time. And I continue to own China. I am not buying in the U.S., and I own very little in the U.S. now because U.S. is near all-time highs. Well, China's still 30% below its all-time high. I'd rather buy something that's down rather than something at all-time highs.
Are you watching the rate drama with the Federal Reserve, the FOMC? Do you have any predictions on whether it'll be September or December this year when they finally pull the trigger on this rate hike?
Well, I'm not so much watching the Fed as I'm watching the markets. You know, the Fed, for all the publicity it gets, the Fed really just follows the market more than anything else. Watch what the market's doing. That's really going to dictate when interest rates will go higher, short-term interest rates. I suspect that it will be a while yet because the American economy is not terribly strong or doesn't appear to be. So, and certainly other economies, you don't have higher interest rates in other economies, so there's not that kind of competitive pressure. I wouldn't be shorting interest rates. I wouldn't be expecting interest rates to go higher anytime soon. If and when they do go higher, the obvious best play is to short junk bonds because the spreads between high-grade bonds and junk bonds are the narrowest or near the narrowest in history. So that will be the play because then next time around you'll have interest rates going higher, the spreads widening, and obviously problems in the economy, which will hurt junk bonds even more.
So you don't then expect a infinitesimal rate hike or two just so the Fed can save face, if you will, on their calls for higher rates?
Well, that could very well happen, Chris, and that's insightful. What happens and when that happens, let's say they raise interest rates a couple of times. Well, the markets are going to go down, and that we haven't had a big correction in a long time, as you know, so we're well overdue. Markets will start going down. Everybody will call the Federal Reserve and say, you've got to save Western civilization. We're about to destroy everything that mankind has stood for. And so then the Fed, you know, the people at the Fed are just bureaucrats and academics. They don't know anything. They'll get scared, and they'll probably say, okay, we're sorry. We'll loosen up again. So you'll see them loosen up again. And that may well then lead the U.S. market into its final top and into a bubble, possibly, if that happens. Because somewhere along the line, we cannot continue with these absurd interest rates, to continue this absurd money printing. And somewhere the market's going to take the whole thing away from the central bank, and the market will decide.
I really would appreciate your thoughts on the U.S. dollar. I mean, it's been a remarkable, almost one-year rally. Has come under pressure in the last few weeks, substantial pressure, but still the trend markedly higher, washing out 12 years of losses, technically speaking at least. Is this purely a knee-jerk reaction as folks try to flee trouble in the EU? Or is there something that might sustain this dollar?
The U.S. dollar is my longest currency position, not because I have any confidence in the U.S. dollar. Yeah, well, it has been for a while, but the U.S. dollar is a terribly flawed currency, Chris. We're the largest debtor nation in the history of the world, and it's getting worse and worse. You may say, then, well, why do you own it? I own it because, you know, there's going to be a lot more turmoil coming. There already has been a lot of currency turmoil and market turmoil. There's more coming. And in periods of turmoil, people look for safe havens. Many people consider the U.S. dollar a safe haven. Now, it is not a safe haven by any stretch of the imagination, but since people think it is, many people will flee to the dollar. And even if it weren't a psychological thing, there are not many, most of the other currencies are having problems these days. So I own it because I expect as turmoil develops, people will flee to the U.S. dollar. It might even turn into a bubble. It has been very strong for a year or so. It certainly is having a little bit of a consolidation and a correction, a well-deserved. The bigger the consolidation, the better, if you ask me, and I own it, because then it can certainly turn around and go much, much higher. I expect the dollar to go much higher during the turmoil of the next year or two or three or whenever it comes. That will be the top, and that will be the time to get out. But it could go up a lot more. Turmoil is likely to be pretty serious.
Virtually every headline indicates that unemployment lowest level in 7 or 8 years since the Great Recession started. However, would you expect, if this were really true, that you'd see so much social unrest?
Well, Chris, the facts are that the U.S. Central Bank and world central banks have been printing staggering amounts of money. Never in recorded history have you had all the major central banks printing so much money at the same time, Japan, UK, Europe, and America. Now, the people getting that money, Chris, are having a wonderful time, and their friends are too. I mean, stockbrokers in Japan and America think that they've died and gone to heaven. They can't believe what things are right now. But likewise, their friends, but it's artificial, and it has to end, and it will end. Artificial ocean of liquidity dries up, either because the market forces it to, or because, you know, the central banks come to their senses, which is unlikely. But when that happens, we're going to have a serious, serious problem. You talk about social unrest. Well, that's partly because many people are not enjoying this little artificial ocean of liquidity. They're in the real world, and the real world is not having nearly as much fun as people sitting here floating in the boat of a lot of printed money.
Well, as we wrap up here, I wonder if you could tell people whether or not we should expect another bestseller in the works here from Jim Rogers.
No, I mean, First of all, I'm stunned. I've done as many books as I have, but I cannot imagine another one. Now, I've said that several times, but I'm very serious. I cannot imagine another one. I don't think that I have anything left to say. Who knows? Maybe I'll live a long time and we'll find plenty of other things to say. But I don't see anything to say right now.
It really does take a lot out of one to pull something like that together. I don't think people really appreciate it who haven't been through the process.
Well, that too, but also I don't want to just write a book to write a book. I mean, I want to make sure I have something to say. And so far, at least in the past, I've felt that I've had something to say. I'm not sure I have anything to say at the moment, not that's worth a whole book. My parting words are very aware of what's going on. Be careful, be worried, and be careful. Sure, I write about it in my books, but more important than my books are just be prepared, because the next time we have a problem in the world, it's going to be really, really bad.
You know, now that they've pulled out all the stops, what type of safety net is left? What do they have left in their magic box?
I mean, nothing. It's put up a lot of PR, but no. I mean, the interest rates are essentially at historic lows. They printed staggering amounts of money. I mean, sure, they can just go out and buy stocks or something and then print even more money. But the game is getting close to an end. We haven't had a recession or hard times in America and the world in 6 years. We're overdue historically. When it comes, because the debt is so, so, so much higher, it's going to be a mess. I mean, I'm still long stock. Don't get me wrong. I'm just saying, please be aware of what's going on, because when it ends, it's going to be serious.
One wonders, with negative interest rates, not just zero, but below zero, how much longer folks will say, sure, you know, you can have my money and I'll pay you for the privilege.
When we look back someday in history, people are going to say, can you believe in 2015 there were negative interest rates and people were paying the governments to lend them money? No. This is not going to last, I assure you. Just be aware of what's going on. Be aware and be prepared.
Since you're in that part of the world, au revoir.
Well, thank you very, very much, Chris. Let's do it again sometime.
Here is your mining quiz for the day, compliments of GoldSeek. Which company has the largest undeveloped gold reserve in North America? Seabridge Gold. Now, which company has the largest undeveloped copper reserve in North America? Seabridge Gold again. Seabridge has more gold reserves than Kinross, Yamana, and Agnico Eagle. Last year alone, Seabridge added 515 million tons of new inferred resources containing nearly 6 million ounces of gold and more than 6 billion pounds of copper at their giant KSM project in British Columbia, Canada. Now they are drilling at KSM again with multiple rigs in a 25,000-meter program. Find out more by visiting www.seabridgegold.net. Traded on the NYSE, symbol SA, and the TSX, symbol SEA.
GoldSeek employees may or may not own shares. Nothing contained herein should be construed as investment advice.
Peter Leides watches the markets with a close eye and pays attention to the cycles, looking for important market opportunities. He's made guest appearances on CNBC Wall Street Week, featured in Barron's and Wall Street Journal. Welcome back, Peter Leides.
Thank you very much, Chris. I appreciate that. And what a great time to be talking about the stock market, too. I have a lot of things to talk about, things that I think that are important to the market, Chris. Okay, I put out a special report that was dated. Date on it was, I believe, April 26th, but not, let me confirm that. Yep, Stock Market Cycles Report, April 26th, 2015. Let me read you the last paragraph of that report, Chris, and then we'll go into some detail on it. I said two paragraphs, actually. Let's end this report with one more taunting observation. There were 1,897 trading days between the major high on March 24th of 2000 and the major high on October 11th of 2007 on the S&P. Try adding an equivalent 1,897 trading days to the October 11th, 2007 top, and you would find that now, even as the market is at or slightly above a mystical trend line I talked about, we have written about in depth in this report, the 1,897 trading day equivalent distance from October 11th, 2007 falls on Monday, April 27th. And then I showed a chart that expressed that equality in weeks, which was exactly 394. My last paragraph says, exciting? You bet it is. But we've been excited by things in the past that didn't seem to work out. But unless we find out differently, and we should know within just a few days if the market moves higher, we could well be looking at a very major market top registered between Friday, April 24th, and Monday, April 27th. In a lot of ways, it doesn't calculate. The daily advanced decline line continues to move to new all-time highs, and that has almost always meant even higher highs lie ahead in the market indexes, which generally will not top until there are negative divergences in the advanced decline line. As long as you are aware of that, however, we would not chastise you if you look for a major market top right here and now. I felt very strong at the time, Chris, and let me give you one of the reasons why. This is technically oriented, but it's a rather simplistic technical line that I think anyone that does any technical work at all on the market will be able to replicate. Don't ask me how I first came up with the concept of using this line and following it into the future, but I did within days of producing this report. A few days earlier, I was playing around with charts and looking at lines and cycles like I always do. And I happened to put a trend line on the intraday lows of October 28th of 1997 for the S&P. That low was 855.27. And the October 8th of 98 low on the S&P, which was 923.30. Those were both called October crashes at the time. Of course, they were nothing like the real October crash of 1987, but they were referred to as October crashes. Now, that line, any trend line, has a slope to it. It's a straight line. It has a defined slope. So I didn't realize it at the time, but when I went forward in time and looked at that trend line, I was amazed by the amount of times it was hitting incredible turning points in the market. So I went back and tried to define the line, and that's very easily done. There were 238 trading days between those two lows, and the two lows represented a point spread of 68.03 points. So I simply divided 68.03, the number of points between them, by the number of trading days, not calendar, but trading days between them, which is 238. And that came to an answer of 0.28584, carried out to five places. That was the slope of that line. I don't know if this is boring at all, but believe me, if anyone puts this line on a chart, they will be dumbfounded by the line. In 2001 and 2002, you came down. Remember, this is initially a bottoms line, so the market was on top of it all the way going into 2001. It started to come back down, and in 2001, it came down to the line, closed exactly on the line, and when I say exactly, I mean within one S&P point, and that was approximately, I think, a 20-25% decline into that line, coming down to it, and then from that exact close on the line, it rallied 19% up in several weeks. So the line was an incredibly important turning point for the S&P at that time. It came down to the line again and broke it convincingly. And that break, which occurred, I believe, anyway, it happened in late 2001. Once that line was broken, Chris, it became a resistance line for the market to this very day. I remember this happened in 2002, so that was 13 years ago. here are the times where the market came up the line after breaking below it. In July of 2007, as you recall, there were two tops in 2007, July and October. The market came virtually exactly up to that line in 2007, July, stopped at it and pulled back, had a nice little decline, and once again, in October of 2007, at that top, the market came up to the line again and stopped. From that point, of course, we had the second worst bear market in the 100-year history, going back, the Dow going back to 1896, a decline of about 55% in the popular averages that carried into March 2009. Mind you, as that happened, the line that we're talking about continued to march up at the rate of around a quarter of a point every trading day. And at that time, I must admit, if you asked me, I would tell you I didn't think that line would ever be reached again. I thought that we were in a secular bear market, and I felt very strongly that the market was not going to do well over the next 10 or 15 years. But anyway, the market did carry a lot further than I and most other people suspected. But guess what, Chris? By December of last year, that line was once again approached by the S&P. We came up to the line, touched it virtually exactly, had that big decline that we had from December going into January, and now finally, for about two or three times, coming into March and April, the line was approached very closely again. We actually closed a little bit above it. By the way, we have never closed more than, I think, 1.1% above that line since 2002. All these excursions up to the line were always blocked. There were a couple of closes that took place a little bit above the line, a little bit below, but never more than 1.1% above. Over the past 2 weeks, Chris, we came up to the line again. And as of Monday of this past week, when we saw our little secondary top, that line was at exactly 2114.40 on the S&P cash. The S&P cash that day closed at 2114.49. That's 2 days ago on this past Monday. So within 9 cents of an exact close on that high. And as they say, the rest is history. 2 days, of course, don't mean a darn thing. We don't know what's going to happen here. We could turn around tomorrow and go up to new highs again. But that line has been so incredibly important for so long, Chris, that anytime we get to it or close to it, I think we should be looking for potential tops of major importance.
What do you think is the driving force here that causes the market to cap, to top out, to reach a zenith as price approaches that level?
What it must be, at least in the case of the S&P, is that this is a natural ascension for the S&P. In other words, this is the rate at which, within a certain realm of the economy and what's happening in the background, this is a certain rate of ascent that is somehow endemic to the S&P. It's the way it rises. And when it reaches that point, because this has been ever since 2002, it has been a topping point. It's been a point where the market has become exhausted. And so it's kind of saying, hey, we did a lot of catching up from the 2009 low coming into this high, but we've once again reached that rate of ascent, which has stopped the market cold for the past 12 years, and it's done it once again. That's the only logical explanation that I can come up with for you. You have to really have a belief, as I do, in how markets work, that they really have very little to do with fundamentals. Obviously, the fundamentals are important to the long-term trend, but in terms of market timing, not very important at all. So the cycles move around the fundamentals, either sideways, slanting up at different rates of ascent, or coming down at different rates of decline. And the cycles move around that. This particular line is a rate of ascent, which has been established now. We're going back now, Chris, we're going back to 97, 98. So we're talking about, what, 97, 07, 17, almost 20 years, about 18 years of this line ruling the markets. We have an exact angle, or as I would say, a slope, and that's, let me repeat that again for people, because if they use as a reference point the close of the S&P, on Monday of this week at 2114.49. That trend line, as I said earlier, was at 2114.40. So that's 2114.40 versus 2114.49. If they want to get their charts out and put a lot at the beginning, put a point at 2114.40, I don't know how closely they want to put that. I guess they could put it at 2114 and they'll be pretty close. And then just have that line rise at the slope of the line, which is 0.28584 points per day. Then they will be able to follow that line ad infinitum into the future. Here's another interesting thing about the line, Chris. And obviously, there are no guarantees. We all know anything can happen in the stock market. Maybe this line will stop being the resistance that it's been now for 12 or 13 years. But even if the market does not top now, goes down, comes up, goes down, comes up, as long as it's being ruled by that line, by the end of the year, this line is only about 2 to 3% higher than it was at the recent highs in the last week or two. So that should show you what the maximum upside potential is for the market between not current prices, but where we were on Monday of this week.
I take it then that your position is increasingly bearish as we break out to new highs, at least in terms of the S&P and the NASDAQ. Things have gotten a bit frothy for you in recent months.
Absolutely. I believe that, I mean, if one looks at, I think a great fundamentalist is Huffman Funds. People can go, that's a free website that they can look at every week. If they have a major understanding of valuation, I think John Huffman does a fabulous job explaining where this market is in terms of long-term historical fundamentals. And by long-term, I'm talking about not the last 10 or 20 years, but the last 100 years. Anytime we've reached this area of overvaluation has been almost written in stone that the compound annual growth rate for the market over the next 10 years is either going to be negative or at most provide a 1 or 2% return per year, which of course is ridiculously low. But that's what the valuation picture is showing us.
Well, you've certainly given us much to digest. It'll be interesting to put these numbers up on the charts and take a look and see where this trend line leads us and where it's been. Peter Leides, hat tip for all the work that you do there. And, I look forward to seeing how things shape up for the rest of the year. We'll touch back later on in 2015.
Always a pleasure to talk to you, Chris. Thank you.
Here is your mining quiz for the day, compliments of GoldSeek. Which company has the largest undeveloped gold reserve in North America? Seabridge Gold. Now, which company has the largest undeveloped copper reserve in North America? Seabridge Gold again. Seabridge has more gold reserves than Kinross, Yamana, and Agnico Eagle. Last year alone, Seabridge added 515 million tons of new inferred resources containing nearly 6 million ounces of gold and more than 6 billion pounds of copper at their giant KSM project in British Columbia, Canada. Now they are drilling at KSM again with multiple rigs in a 25,000-meter program. Find out more by visiting www.seabridgegold.net. Traded on the NYSE, symbol SA, and the TSX, symbol SEA.
GoldSeek employees may or may not own shares. Nothing contained herein should be construed as investment advice.
David Morgan joins us here. He writes the Morgan Report and runs SilverInvestor.com. Welcome back, David.
Chris, great to be back.
Well, it's great to have you back. You know, we were talking before the show about the greenback rally and just what it's meant to the markets. On the one hand, obviously, you have a flight from the EU where there's the Greek exit issue and other problems there. So money fleeing from negative interest rates, you know, what a bargain that is. So the U.S., the greenback just, you know, looks good by comparison. Still, it's an ailing currency. Tell us what this means for investors.
Well, right now, what we've seen is a flee into the dollar, and it's because people perceive that it's a safe haven asset. And actually, relative to other currencies, it probably is. Having said that, the main premise of my work and many others in this sector is that fiat currencies always are destroyed. And the proof is very easy for anyone that takes just a few minutes to research the Federal Reserve itself. It's $13 worth of about force today. So that's a huge inflation over the last 100 years or so. And now we're kind of arguing over, you know, how strong that last 4 cents worth is. And right now it's actually stronger than the other currencies that are out there because it's superior from the aspect as there aren't as many uncertainties as there is, let's say, with the euro right now, with the Greek, Spain, Ireland, Italy, et cetera. So when this started recently, and I'm talking very short term here, we actually were seeing gold and the dollar go up together. And this was perplexing a lot of people because they felt that, you know, they go the opposite directions, gold up, dollar down, dollar up, gold down. And yet I expect to see that continue over time because the smart money will be moving into gold. Money that doesn't know any better will be seeking safe haven into something that's not as good, and that would be the U.S. dollar. So it doesn't surprise me.
We saw surprising dollar weakness somewhat in the commodities with the exception of West Texas Intermediate crude. And this would seem to be indicative of separation, if you will, from that lockstep with the yellow metal and silver with this reserve currency. Should we expect more of that? I mean, should we be focusing less, I guess, on the greenback?
I think so. I mean, it's more than the reverse of the dollar. It's, you know, there's arguments both, you know, all over the place. And you have people like, you know, Harry Dent that says, you know, it's not a crisis hedge. I contend it is. I contend that in an inflation, deflation, stagflation, or some name we haven't made up yet, that the more uncertain the financial slash monetary system becomes, the more people seek certainty, regardless of what the uncertainty is. Again, inflation or deflation or something in between. And that means a run to gold. And that is what we've really witnessed. We've seen a run to gold by China, Russia, India. We've seen a run out of gold and a run to paper from the Anglo-American Empire primarily. You've seen this, the establishment maintain that it's a barbarous relic and it doesn't have any meaning in the financial system and it's not money, it's only tradition, and on they go with their same old saw that's been proven through, you know, thousands of years of history to be a lie. That's the only monetary metal, silver and gold, both, the only two monetary metals that have survived. Doesn't mean that their value hasn't changed. It has. But so have the economies. You know, I mean, you know, you could buy for a silver denarius in Roman times. What would you buy with a dime worth of silver today? Well, you have a lot more options today than you would have back then. Anyway, I digress, but that's the idea.
Obviously, gold, silver, long-term, the go-to asset classes. However, you're also known for your technical work, and we both have a penchant for that. Talking with Jim Rogers last night, he also agrees with this thesis. The monthly, the longer term, even in the near term, we've been treading water for 2 years here, and it looks a little ominous. You know, despite the bounces we have from week to week, it looks as though there might have to be a final washout. He's waiting for that. What do you think?
I disagree, but I've been wrong before. Anyone that's listened to me either privately or publicly, and I admit it, I don't get it right 100% of the time, and no one else does. But regardless, just interviewed Avi Gilbert. I met him at the PDAC in Canada recently, and he believes exactly the same issue, that it looks like a setup that there will be one more washout bottom. And so I interviewed him for the Morgan Report that just got published a couple of days ago. And he goes through it, and it's, you know, very much a benefit if he's right to people. And if he's wrong, then buying at this range isn't going to hurt you. If you don't know where the bottom is, the best approach is a dollar cost average. I mean, and if you want to trade it, there are ways to do it, which I do and teach and show, that will actually get you into the market if and only if the market itself tells you it's going higher. Yeah, and that's how I've traded for years because I had to lose a lot of money to figure that out. I've had those days licking my wounds, believe me. Make the market prove it.
No, the veterans always, you know, talk about the learning curve. I mean, everybody from Livermore up to so many of the greats, Granditch, and most of them come to the same conclusion. You know, over time, dollar cost averaging into the trend is, you know, in the longer term, in the bigger picture, picking it up steadily over time, it's not going to make much difference 5-10 years from now whether you got the exact nadir. Let's move on to some of the other geopolitical issues facing the markets. Obviously, we have trouble in the EU. And then, of course, we have some unrest in the United States. With rehypothecation, with the threat of bail-ins, with the threat of something like a quadrillion interest rate-sensitive notional derivative risk, $250 trillion, I get my numbers right here, in our major money center banks in the United States. Our top five or six banks are carrying about $250 trillion with a T, interest rate-sensitive derivatives. Almost every Fed funds contract that I can find is predicting with a 100% chance we're going to have higher rates somewhere around September to December of this year, so 2015. What kind of a risk do you see with so much bad debt? Bill Gross looking for a big meltdown in the bond sector. It's a huge sector. Why would anybody be taking on such low rates with the threat of higher rates and negative interest rates in Europe to make the prospects for the precious metals sanguine?
Exactly. I agree. There's really no reason to do it if you have any kind of financial experience. Having said that, the trade has been to go long the bond market for a long time. These are what usually cycles are in the bond market, these 30-year cycles. But I've said over and over, even though, you know, silver is my specialty and precious metals and the macro picture or whatever, I don't put myself in too small a box. I'm much bigger than just the silver market. But regardless, the biggest trade on the planet is going to be shorting the bond market at the right time. And the problem is, as you outlined so well, there are so many notional value derivatives surrounding the debt markets that the ability for everyone to settle is impossible. So what that means is the people that bet right and are quote-unquote making money on their trade might not get paid. And that it goes back to our original thesis about why gold, why silver, why now? Well, the reason for those questions and the answer is because there's nothing that's going to be more important than preservation of capital once this bond bubble starts to break. And that is going to cause a flee in the gold like we've never seen in financial history. It's going to move these markets into paper terms that I think I'd sound ridiculous to tell you because, one, I don't know and no one else does. But when you consider what the balance of the teeter-totter is, and you put gold on silver on one side of the teeter-totter, and on the other side you put this debt bomb that is going to explode on the other side, and you look at the mass of each, how much quote-unquote dollars are represented by the debt markets versus how much dollars are represented by the precious metals. And there's such an unbelievable imbalance that when that tries to balance, and it will, which means there is going to be an explosion. Again, I repeat myself for emphasis, in the financial markets that have never been witnessed in human history before.
This pendulum has swung so far over into the paper side. It's almost as though the powers that be have just lost control of the train. You know, I mean, it's just off the rails and looking for something to careen into or off of. The system was really over in 2008. I think only people who stare at charts all day long, who have a mental defect and just love to look at patterns and charts, think back to 2008, 2009. Across the board, with the exception of, I think it was T-bonds or something, short-term bonds, I mean, everything was destroyed. I mean, I remember solid blue-chip companies trading at like 70 cents, Ford trading for like a dollar. But one thing held up, and that was gold. But I do hear unanimously across the board, in the mainstream and in the fringe even, that you can expect something much more challenging than 2008, 2009. Well, under that scenario, you've looked at the charts and you see the only thing that held up was gold. This is just a fantastic opportunity to be looking for some portfolio insurance.
Well, I just want to emphasize the point you just made, because some people think that the only place to go is gold and silver, and that's really not true. And so you need to weigh what your worldview is. I mean, do you think that we're going to, you know, muddle through? There's going to be a huge disruption. There's going to be a reset. There's probably going to be a new financial or monetary system and that type of thing. And so the point I'm making is, what is the right amount for you? And no one can answer that question except you. I've suggested in the Investing Rules, which is the first real publication I did in a mainstream, you know, quote unquote, big way is suggest 10% is the right amount for most people. And that's probably still true. So that gives you 90% to invest in what? Well, you know, stock market's been a pretty good place. I think it's overvalued, but it doesn't mean it can't become more overvalued. That's where the action's been in the last few years. Real estate, if you get it right, I mean, I'm not a big real estate investor personally, but I mean, there's a lot of people I've met through my travels because I travel all over, as you know, Chris, and I've met a lot of people whose main wealth was built by real estate. And again, if you buy it right, time it right, whatever. So there are other things, and there's always innovation out there, even in the worst of times. I mean, even in the Great Depression, that they make cornbread in a box, I think you buy for 15 cents. That was a business that started in the Great Depression. You think, well, you couldn't have a box pre-made, you know, cornbread make money in the Depression. Guess what? It was very successful. So there's always things out there. So I'm just trying to say balance it. The most negative feedback I get are usually for people that think that they could time the market, mistime it, they will blame me or somebody else, they overload, they put in too much, or they borrow to do it, and all of a sudden it's all my fault. And this doesn't happen often. Most people are adults or mature, but a lot of people, you know, some that aren't. And it's like, I'm on Chris's show explaining the value of having a position in the metals, not all of your earnings in metals. I've never advocated that. Having said that, I have to give the caveat that certainly there are some people that follow my work or your work or others' work that have made the decision that that's the only place they want to be. Look, I'm free market. If that's what they decide, that's okay with me. I'm not going to tell them not to. But what I am saying is for most people, you're better served by having a position that is going to protect you regardless of what the economy does, inflation, deflation, or something in between, and go about your business. Because a lot of people really are not that financial savvy. And that's good advice, in my view, that you just take a position, and the best way to do it really is dollar cost average. But if you're just going to do it, just say 10%. So what else is on my mind? I haven't thought of this in a long time, Chris. It just came to mind. But, you know, one of my mentors, one of the men I respect the most, Harry Brown, and he came up with a permanent portfolio. And I read that book twice. When I read it, I wasn't that impressed because I was young and, you know, too much of a metals head and maybe too overinvested in that sector, whatever. But Harry spread it out. And what you do is just rebalance like once a year. So let's say you have 10% in the metals and you bought it at 19 in 2010. And then it shot up to, you know, 48. And you just happen to be, for your particular case, rebalancing then, and that 10% is now 35% of your portfolio. What you do is you rebalance. You say, well, I have to sell some to get it back down to the 10% holding is supposed to be permanently. Because there's, you know, things vary. And then I put that into the bond market or the stock market. Anyway, it's a brilliant strategy. It's pretty simple to implement, and it does keep you diversified. And people say, oh, well, you're too diversified, you can't make money. No, if you look at that strategy, and you've probably found it on Google, I haven't tried myself, but you look at the permanent portfolio from Harry Brown, that is a great strategy to diversify and make money in almost any economic condition.
First of all, how many people called the dollar rally? But if you had a 5% investment in the greenback, you know, maybe through UUP or some other ETF or however you want to, the futures contract, your portfolio benefited. How many people really expected real estate to come roaring back the way they did? Well, we called the bottom in 2012, 3 years early, but we didn't know the magnitude that it would come roaring back. And very few people expected the stock market rally to go without even a significant, you know, decline for as many years as it has. Frankly, I mean, Markowitz was right, you know. It's the only free lunch. It sounds like you're looking for a tradable bottom here in the precious metals markets this year.
Well, I think the bottom came in late last year. I think it was late November, early December of 2014. And we saw a print around the $14.15 mark in the silver market. Whether any actual trades took place there other than maybe one futures contract, I don't know. In fact, I doubt it. In other words, a lot of these spike bottoms that I'm kind of famous for talking about, they happen so quickly that all that means is maybe one or two trades actually took place on paper. It wasn't anybody out there that was buying physical silver that day at $14.15, I guarantee it. Anyway, the point being is I think that's it. But, again, Avi Gilbert, that I interviewed in the May edition of the Morgan Report, disagrees. A lot of sound guys that I, you know and trust think that's going lower. So it's got to get below that level for it to make a new low. If it does, it's obviously an opportunity. If you're sitting at a computer and can trade, you know, all day, maybe you can, you know, find the bottom if it comes. If not, I think the best approach, just to reiterate, is just go ahead and start in here and average in, accumulate. The pros accumulate and distribute. They accumulate stock or a commodity or an investment, and they do it quietly over time so that they don't rock the market. And then they do the same thing when they sell it. They distribute it over time, and they never look for an exact bottom or an exact top. They look for a band. They look to buy within the 20% range of the bottom and sell in the 20% range of the top. And that's what they do. And so it's good to take on that type of an attitude, the professional type of an attitude. If you bought higher, and a lot of people have, and you bought the right amount, meaning, you know, 10%, 20%, whatever, I would not recommend for most people going over, say, the 20% level. You know, you can still sleep at night. Yes, you're off, and if you had to cash it out, and some people may, and I'm sorry that they do, but if you don't have to cash it out, got other things going on in your life, you don't have to focus on the price of these metals every day. I think a lot of people that are in the sector just get so much of a micromanagement type of an attitude about, oh my goodness, gold went up, you know. And it's frustrating. I mean, I watch the market every day, and I have most of my adult life. I mean, for 40 years, it's, you know, there's very few days I didn't know what the price of gold and silver were doing. It's my profession, and I can take it in stride, even though, you know, I don't like these massive hits that happen from time to time. But we're in a quiet period. No one wants it. It's under love. No one cares about it. So we must be very close to a bottom.
I would just caution folks that if, like you say, you know, 20%, and please no leverage, because in my experience, the professionals that I've seen who have been really successful in the industry, they don't buy bottoms. I mean, they just, and there's a few exceptions to that rule. Jim Rogers, although he's very humble, always seems to catch the bottom of every market, it seems. But for the rest of them that I've seen who are successful, almost unanimously buy higher highs, you know, in the monthly and chart. And I just, I'm not seeing that in the, and I can't wait for it to happen. I'll be the first one to ring the bell. Until I see that major trend shift, no, I'm going to miss the bottom 20%, and I usually miss the top 20%, but it's that 60% in the middle that I find the most interesting. And that's where I want people to be positioned. Not everybody can do that. And the best way to participate in the big moves is to have, you know, a slice or two of every sector that you can. So diversification is a big winner there. Any contact information for people?
Sure. The best way is just go to themorganreport.com. That's all one word, themorganreport.com. And if you're interested in our new book, you can go to thesilvermanifesto.com.
All right, David Morgan, we appreciate you as always. Look forward to having you back on the show.
Thank you, Chris.
Hey Chris, this is Robert Ian with ConquerChange.com. This week, I was visiting someone in the hospital, and while I was waiting, was given a Wi-Fi code for my iPad. I eventually logged on and was trying to make my way around the web to do a cursory review of several alternative media sites as an antidote to the mainstream news that was playing loud on the waiting room television. I noticed using Google Chrome that several of the sites visited evoked that sick-looking, sad face that pops up when you cannot connect to the website you are seeking. I thought maybe it was just a bad connection. So I went to a few more of my favorites, and no luck. Then for the heck of it, I punched in CNN.com, and what do you know, it popped up right on my browser. I tried a few more mainstream media sites, and they all came up. I even punched in a few sites that were rated well above PG-13, and they came up, in case certain content was being censored on a public Wi-Fi system. Then I went back to several alternative media websites that got that sick-looking, sad face once again, and started to wonder if maybe certain websites with certain key words, or at least enough of them, could get a site filtered in certain places. The technology certainly exists. I was almost ready to amuse myself by asking to speak to the Internet administrator. But then, lo and behold, the previously missing websites appeared on my browser. But it got me thinking. How easy it would be to accomplish what I thought might be happening right there in the hospital lobby. What was alarming is that of my two websites, one was visible, which was my speaking website, robertian.com. However, my commentary website, conquerchange.com, came up with that sad-looking face once again. Fortunately, there was no problem. But the scenario always exists for this kind of problem moving forward. Electronic censorship is one of the greatest invisible threats lurking in the depths of the Internet, and many will not know they are victims of it unless they are diligent in understanding the scope of where their message is penetrating and who is seeing it on a regular basis. Stay abreast, stay informed, and stay tuned. Chris, I'd like to urge all of our listeners to sign up for my email list at conquerchange.com. And if any of our listeners are ever involved in bringing in keynote speakers for their companies or professional organizations, please visit my companion website at robertian.com. And until next time, this is Robert Ian with conquerchange.com, reminding you to follow us on Twitter at conquerchange. Thanks, Chris.